Before we begin our third case this morning, I'd like to thank Judge John Eklund of the 11th District Court of Appeals for sitting in for Justice Bruner today. Thank you. This is 2023-0411, Tara versus Rice Drilling. On behalf of the appellants, Ms. Rotman. Good morning.
Good morning. Anna Rotman, on behalf of the appellants Rice Drilling D and Gulfport Corporation, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The question before this court is whether the contract's label, Utica Shale, should be interpreted as it was commonly known, as Judge Robb did in her dissent, or should be interpreted stratigraphically, as the lower court did. The proper interpretive tool is found in the language of the contract itself, which says this court must define it as it is commonly known. The lower court erred as a matter of law by ignoring the language commonly known as in the grant of the lease, rendering that language superfluous and gutting the contract of its essential purpose, which was for Rice to extract gas from Tara's land so Tara could earn royalties. And Rice, in fact, has paid it millions in royalties. Once the court interprets Utica Shale as it was commonly known, reasonable minds can only find that the common understanding in eastern Ohio at the time was that the Utica Shale included the Point Pleasant Formation where Rice's wells were drilled. Why? Because the overwhelming record shows that in eastern Ohio at the time, the Utica Shale was discussed in connection with drilling for gas, and the productive portion of the Utica Shale is the Point Pleasant. Tara's own expert and engineering geologist testified that in 2012, quote, the public thought of the producing unit as just the Utica. The lower court's opinion, therefore, must be vacated, and as Judge Robb concluded, it should be reversed and rendered. Now, to the extent that the court reaches the bad faith trespass issue, the lower court's opinion erred as a matter of law by holding that a mineral trespass defendant who has, according to the court, misinterpreted an unambiguous contract has acted in bad faith as a matter of law. That holding ignores the principles that bad faith is a fact question and that a fact finder must examine all material evidence of good faith. It should be reversed as well. Now, with respect to the lower court's opinion not considering the language commonly known as, let me start by saying if the contract said that Rice was leasing the Utica Shale only, perhaps it would be ambiguous because there is a technical understanding and a common understanding. But the contract solves for that ambiguity. The plain language says that Tara leased to Rice the formation known as the Utica Shale. So then the question becomes, well, what is it to be commonly known as? That's the language that must be interpreted here. The U.S. Supreme Court actually, in a 1927 case, interpreted these very words, commonly known as, in the context of a tariff that applied to products commonly known as clothing wool. And the Supreme Court found clothing wool should be defined as what a non-expert reader of the word would understand. The Court of Appeals here committed a clear legal error by insisting on what it literally said was a technical stratigraphic meaning of Utica Shale. Nowhere does the lease use the language technical
One way to understand this commonly used as language is that its formation commonly known as Utica Shale. Utica Shale is not technically a formation, so that's why it's a shale. That's why they use that commonly known as language. What about that? What about that reading?
Right. So that reading turns on the assertion, which was found in the appellee's brief, that Utica Shale isn't known as a formation. There is no support in the record for that. I would actually implore the court to look at what they cited for that, which was our own petroleum engineer. He never says that the Utica Shale isn't a formation. And in any event, there is nothing in the record that says that what is commonly known as the Utica Shale is geological terminology in Ohio, which is what they are arguing. What is commonly known, the formation commonly known as the Utica Shale, still requires the court to understand how the formation was commonly known at the time. A formation is just a rock unit. And so the test for the court still is to understand what was this rock unit known as the commonly known as the Utica Shale, how was it commonly known at the time? Formation doesn't do anything magical in terms of now couching it in geology such that we don't have to read commonly known as and apply it. We still have to.
What about the fact that the lease uses Utica Shale in the later part without that commonly known language? Does that matter?
Not when you read the contract as a whole, and actually not when you read even the sentence in the reservation as a whole. So the lease uses commonly known as Utica Shale again and again. And when we get to that particular sentence in the reservation, I would ask the court to actually look at the language in that reservation, because over the course of one sentence, it's actually page 6 of Tara's brief, in case the court would want to follow along. The structure of the sentence in 3 subparts uses Marcellus Shale and Utica Shale twice with the identical pattern. So it starts at number 1, from the surface to the top of the formation commonly known as the Marcellus Shale. That's the first time. It's long form. 2, in any and all formations below the base of the Marcellus Shale. The second time, 9 words later, it's short form, to the top of the formation commonly known as the Utica Shale. First time mentioned, long form. 3, in all formations below the base of the Utica Shale. 9 words later, it's the short form. The idea that this court, and actually what the lower court said is, well, they have to read the grant in light of the reservation. The idea that it cannot be that subpart A3 of this entire sentence read in isolation trumps the grant clause, because you still then are giving no meaning to the phrase commonly known as in the grant clause. And it renders an absurd result. The contract itself says that the sole purpose of the contract there in Article 1 is to lease the land for the sole purpose of exploring for, producing, and gathering the oil and gas. The plaintiff's experts all testified that stratigraphically, the Utica Shale is not a producing unit. So they would be, and let's just understand what a producing unit is. A producing unit is where the gas is actually extracted from. Their engineering geologist said, this area, the Utica Shale, is best described as a caprock and not a producing unit. A caprock is a layer of impervious rock overlying a deposit of gas. The idea that you would be drilling and seeking to only lease out an impervious layer of shale that cannot produce gas is the only logical conclusion from a stratigraphic interpretation. The record actually is clear that that was not what Tara intended. They testified that the reason that they entered into this lease was, in fact, to earn royalties, and we've paid them millions of royalties. So to read the reservation language so narrowly, only subpart A3, doesn't get over the superfluity of commonly known as in the granting clause, and renders the whole contract absurd. I would also note that there is Ohio case law that points out that the reservation clause is to be read it's the Corso case from the Southern District, that the reservation clause is to be read narrowly, and it's to be read in favor of the grantor, that is Rice in this case. So then the question becomes, if we're implementing the common understanding of Utica Shale, in Eastern Ohio at that time that the lease was entered into, the common understanding of Utica Shale included the Point Pleasant Formation. We know that because the record is overwhelming. Terra's experts themselves testified that the formation commonly known as the Utica Shale included the Point Pleasant Formation. And if this seems confusing, it's because you need to realize that Terra is only viewing this stratigraphically and geologically, and in so doing is rendering that language superfluous. So when you input commonly known as, and as the Supreme Court tells us, that means what would a non-expert understanding be? Again, the record is overwhelming. Their own expert, engineering geologist, testified. In Belmont County, when I see something that says we are producing from the Utica, they mean the Point Pleasant Formation. Even though somebody says Utica, we all know that means the Point Pleasant. That's their expert. Their other expert testified that in 2012, his general sense in working with the public, which he said he had done quite a bit, is that the public thought of the producing area as just the Utica. So that's what the experts say. Now, and talking about how it was commonly understood, we can also look at newspapers as a reference for how it was commonly known. And again, the newspapers, when they reference the Point Pleasant, it is as part of the Utica Shale. So, for example, there's an article from the local newspaper, the Times Leader, on February 2013, that said, three additional Utica / Point Pleasant wells are planned in Monroe County. Production from these Utica wells will be gathered and delivered. So in referring to these Utica Point Pleasant wells, the local newspaper, reflecting how the public in the public square is discussing these, refers to them as Utica wells. Another article from 2012 from the Times Leader, talking about the appellant Gulfport, says, Gulfport is drilling into the Utica and Point Pleasant formation, which has been described as, quote, the organically rich lower formation of the Utica Shale. So the Point Pleasant is the organically rich lower formation of the Utica Shale. And if we look at how regulators have considered what was commonly known as the Utica Shale, or even differentiated between the Utica and the Point Pleasant, in the record, there's a press release from 2019 from ODNR, from the Ohio Department of Natural Resources. And in that press release, they tout Ohio's 2019 Utica Shale third quarter production totals, referring to all gas production in the area as production from the Utica Shale. Now, we know from the plaintiff's own experts, there's no dispute that where are they drilling? Where is this gas being extracted from? It's being extracted from the Point Pleasant Formation that's part of the Utica Shale. But why, in a publicly facing press release, is ODNR referring to it as the Utica Shale? Because when people in Eastern Ohio are talking about the producing area, they refer to it as the Utica Shale. The gas itself is coming from the Point Pleasant Formation. Another example of regulators that Judge Robb relied on in her dissent is Terra's engineering expert was asked about the U.S. Energy Administration information failing to distinguish between production in the Utica Shale and the Point Pleasant, and he testified all that changed in 2017. This is years after this contract was entered into. I see that I'm getting low on my time, so I will reserve the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, good morning, Mr. Wilson.
Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy. May it please the court. My name is Craig Wilson. I'm here on behalf of the Appalee Terra LLC, which is Thomas Shaw. Him and his family are filling your gallery here for this case. We appreciate the opportunity to be here. This case boils down to simple contract interpretation. There's no new law, no nothing novel here. We have a contract that is straightforward. It gives two formations, the Utica Shale and the Marcellus Shale. There is no dispute that under plaintiff's property, there is a Utica Shale. There is no dispute that the top of that shale and the bottom of that shale are and were identified by Rice. There is no dispute that the wells were accidentally drilled below that. No, they intentionally went to the Point Pleasant, which is the formation immediately below the base of the Utica Shale. None of that is in dispute. What they want you to do is rewrite the contract. Rewrite the contract so that the oil and gas companies get seven formations. They get the Marcellus Shale, they get the Utica Shale, they get the Point Pleasant, they get the Logana, they get the Lexington, they get the Curdsville member, they get the Trenton. That's what they're asking you to do. Rewrite the contract, give them all of these formations of which...
Is there anything worth drilling for in the Utica Shale?
Your Honor, I don't know. I'm not an engineer. What I can tell you is Toby Rice testified in this case that at the time they signed a lease, there are wells in the Utica Shale. You will say there are wells in the Utica Shale and there were wells in the Point Pleasant. You also hear from Larry Wickstrom, their expert, who says the Utica Shale's prospective. They could drill it. And what I would tell the court is when you look at Jeff Dick, our expert's testimony, he's going to say the wells in northern eastern Ohio, up towards Trumbull County areas, those wells are in the Utica. And the reason they're in the Utica is because the geology has changed there. There, they're not, the Point Pleasant isn't, or the Utica Shale's not acting as a cap rock, it's acting as a source rock. Well, and at trial, there was a bunch of testimony.
I mean, does it make any sense that someone would want a contract to drill into the cap rock, as you say?
Your Honor, I don't think it would make sense to do that, but what I do think is an oil and gas company came to Mr. Shaw's door, knocked on it, and said, we want to lease the Marcellus Shale and the Utica Shale. That's what we want to lease. And Mr. Shaw said, do you want anything else? And the answer was no. So what did they do? They drafted a very carefully constructed contract for the two formations that they asked for.
So does it matter then that the Utica Shale, at the time, there was an understanding that that included the Point Pleasant formation?
Your Honor, I would respectfully posit at the time in 2012, 2013, 2014, a landowner would have no way of knowing that the Utica Shale meant the Point Pleasant. These are not experts. These are landowners.
They're still held to the contract, right?
They're held to the contract.
Isn't there an issue of fact here, then?
I'm not following your
honor. Should this have been decided by summary judgment?
It was on summary judgment.
Isn't there an issue of fact as to what was the meeting of the minds between the parties there?
I don't believe that's true, Your Honor. I think you look at the contract, and can you discern a definitive meaning from that contract? And the answer to that is yes. There is a formation called the Utica Shale. The top and base are identifiable. That's undisputed. That's the definitive meaning that can be given to this contract. We don't have ambiguity. And simply because one company is saying their intent was to get the Point Pleasant, that's a subjective, unexpressed intent. There's nothing in this record that says they told Mr. Shaw that they wanted the Point Pleasant. In fact, you'll hear the exact opposite in the testimony. Toby Rice will testify, we never talked about the Point Pleasant. We only ever talked about the Utica Shale.
Is there a difference between Utica Shale and area commonly known as Utica Shale?
I think it's formation commonly known. I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think there's a Utica Shale formation. And when you talk about the Utica Shale or a formation called Utica Shale, I think we're talking about that rock unit. If they wanted the Point Pleasant, if they wanted the Lexington, if they wanted any of these others, write it in the contract. And that's especially important considering the first sentence of the reservation clause, which says, quote, the lessor reserves all rights not specifically granted to the lessee. We have now just wiped off their entire argument.
Well, but their argument, not necessarily, because their argument is their contract for the Utica Shale included the Point Pleasant. That area commonly known as included the Point Pleasant.
I would posit, Your Honor, that language, They're suggesting that it's not specifically granted.
Okay.
And I would suggest under that wording of this contract, they would lose that because it's not specifically granted to them in this lease. As to bad faith, this is a classic example of bad faith. We have an oil and gas company.
Why can't all evidence come in on bad faith?
I'm sorry?
Why can't all evidence come in on bad faith?
All evidence could come on bad faith. Well, the only evidence that the appellants brought forward was their misunderstanding and
mistake
of law.
Right?
Their objective.
Well, why can't subjective be included?
They absolutely can, and it can be considered. That's absolutely right.
But the court didn't consider it. Right.
Court first step looked at the objective.
And didn't talk about subjective.
You're right, Your Honor. The opinions didn't. But it's in the record. The underlying summary judgment briefs were fully briefed on objective, subjective, what their intent was, who knew what when. All of that's in the record. And the trial court and the Seventh District simply held, this is a mistake of law. This is a mistake of law. There is no doubt in this case that Rice was told days after the Shaws signed this lease, your lease doesn't cover the Point Pleasant. Those are the words from ExxonMobil, XTO Energy. Those are the words. There's no doubt that they didn't know there was a potential problem here. They knew this. And what Toby Rice will testify to is, we thought we knew this. We just didn't think it was a big deal. So we went ahead and drilled.
But that's not what the court held.
That is not what the court held. The court looked at it and said, the contract is unambiguous.
You breached it.
You breached it.
You acted in bad faith.
And you can't meet the objective standard of good faith solely because you have an innocent intent. A reasonable operator would have done more. And we have that in the record as well.
But the court didn't rule that either.
The court looked at just that first piece. It could have looked beyond, and I would posit it absolutely had the right to, and it should, because when we look beyond, what a reasonable operator would have done. ExxonMobil knocks on your door and says, your lease doesn't cover the producing formation. You call up your attorney and say, give me advice of counsel. Or you go knock on Mr. Shaw's door and you say, we need to clarify this. And when you look at the lines of cases that we've cited in our briefing, you have two lines. You have the line that we're talking about, which is the Young case, the Ziegler-Cole case, the Pentris case, the Balmer case. These are all following down. We have a situation where the trespasser knew the risk, they trespassed, and are claiming an honest belief. And all of those cases fall bad faith. You then have the opposite side of that train, which is good faith case law. And here we're seeing companies who didn't know before they trespassed that they had a problem. They then found out, and at the time they trespassed, they had title opinions, they had a judgment entry, they had advice of counsel, something additional to support their basis for a bona fide belief in title. And those cases fall with, those are good faith trespassers. Here we're squarely in the other camp. We have testimony in the record that they knew, and the words from the corporate representative of Rice, this was a business risk. That's the quote. How is that not bad faith? They knew the problem, they drilled it anyway, and here we are today.
My problem is we'll maybe never know because the court never articulated any point of view with regard to those facts in its opinion. So here we sit, right, that when a contract is ambiguous, is clear, is not ambiguous, is unambiguous, and someone breaches it, that's evidence of bad faith.
That's a mistake of law. And this court has long held that a mistake of law is not a defense.
A breach of an unambiguous contract is evidence of bad faith, is what you would have us hold.
I would have this hold that's one factor. But I would have you look at what the trial court did. It started there. The trial court then went on, in its opinion, to analyze the actual evidence. They talk about the ExxonMobil correspondence. They talk about the ODNR hearings where they're standing in front of ODNR, and ODNR looks at this contract and says, what I read, this contract doesn't give you the Point Pleasant. They looked at all of that evidence. They looked at the business risk, the witness testimony, and the trial court put that in its entry when it issued summary judgment on bad faith. You're right, the Seventh District did not do that, but the trial court did.
I'm still having a problem here with summary judgment in this case. If you have so much ammo on both sides about the meaning of this contract term, why is this not a matter for
I would posit that there is no ammo on their side. I heard today overwhelming record several times, which is nice buzzwords, but I would posit, where's the evidence? We have a lot of conjecture. If industry used the term Utica Shale to mean Point Pleasant, they would have thousands of contracts in front of you, or in this record, that they could point to and say, look at this lease. And they'd have endless examples where they did this. There isn't that. None of that exists. What is apparent, and what we have cited in our brief, is in 2013-2014 era, the leases were specifically identifying Utica Shale and Point Pleasant. We see that in leases. We see that in lease assignments. We see that in unitization applications. We see that in ODNR well permits. All of this is indicating the exact contrary position to what the appellants are telling you. I will posit, if you're asking for why, what are they talking about? I think the evolution did happen. I think 2010, there was very few wells drilled in eastern Ohio. And none of them knew which formation they were going for. So in 2010, they come in, they target, they think they're going for the Utica, and I would posit some of those did go to the Utica, based off Dick Yost, or Jeff Dick's testimony, up in the northern part of the play. You then have, they learned, the Point Pleasant's the better formation. And in 2010 and 2012, Ohio legislature adopts a specific statutory definition for the term horizontal well. And in that definition in 2012, it says a well is horizontal if it's in the Point Pleasant, if it's in the Utica, or if it's in the Marcellus. We're distinguishing them. You see that same play happen with ODNR's forms. Before 2010, nobody drilled the Utica, nobody drilled the Point Pleasant. They weren't on the forms. That evolved as more drilling happened. And as that evolution happened, and it all was done by 2012, which is a year and a half before Mr. Shaw ever signed his lease, you're seeing Point Pleasant identified on all of these forms. So I would posit to the court, there is no evidence. This overwhelming record doesn't exist. This is a fallacy made by lawyers. The newspaper articles she discusses to the court all talk about the Point Pleasant. It says Point Pleasant right in them. I would posit this court is just like the Alexander versus Buckeye pipeline case, where they cannot prove enough evidence of trade usage. And I will end on a very strong, what I believe is probably the strongest point against them. The Shaws are not in the trade. They are not oil and gas business people. These are ordinary landowners that it would be absurd to tell them, you know everything about geology. Your basic sense of understanding is landowners would not know that when a company says they Utica Shale, that it actually means Point Pleasant or Trenton or Lexington. That's an absurd statement. These are not experts in the field. So with that, we ask the court to affirm.
Thank you. Ms. Rotman, you have a minute and 28 seconds left.
Thank you. Let me start where my colleague ended, which is why they use this phrase commonly known. It is precisely because we're talking about landowners. And so knowing that they're not experts, the record reflected that the idea was to use something that would be digestible and understandable by the non-expert.
That doesn't make a lot of sense, right? I mean, it certainly wouldn't have hurt the company to be very clear, and that wouldn't have confused the landowners if they'd defined if they said including what's Point Pleasant, that wouldn't have caused any harm to the homeowners. That wouldn't have confused them.
I think that the idea was that they wanted to make it something that was understandable, and what was understandable to a landowner was that where you were, that was that they wanted to have the place where you could extract gas, and as the record overwhelmingly shows, that place is the Point Pleasant, but everyone referred to it as the Utica Shale at the time.
There's not a lot of everyone is. The record's kind of lacking on everyone referred to. You have a few newspaper articles, or one newspaper article, but how do we get to everyone?
Okay, so I would say a couple of things. First of all, there's no contradicting evidence that they have put forward on what was commonly understood to be the Utica Shale. All they have put forward is what was geologically understood to be the delineation between the Point Pleasant and the Utica Shale that evolved over time. There's been no evolution of what was commonly known as the Utica Shale because, as we saw even in 2019, ODNR is referring to the Utica Shale in describing all of the gas production from eastern Ohio that's literally coming out of, or maybe I should say stratigraphically coming out of the Point Pleasant. What Judge Robb looked at was the media, the public, the regulators. This court actually has referred to Utica Shale in decisions about gas production in eastern Ohio. And when it's doing so, it's technically, geologically, stratigraphically referring to the Point Pleasant. But no one says that because it's commonly understood to be the Utica Shale. And on that question, the only issue of fact here is what was commonly known as the Utica Shale. And I would again say that Judge Robb found the record to be overwhelming, that there was no evidence put forth on the other side of what was commonly known as the Utica Shale. And so she concluded that reasonable minds can only find that what was commonly known as the Utica Shale included the Point Pleasant.
As a matter of law?
That's what she concluded. Yeah. She said that she would reverse and render, and that's what we're asking the court to do because they have not put forth any contradicting evidence on this point. They've been answering the wrong question the whole time.
Both arguments in these cases sound like closing arguments in a jury trial.
Unfortunately, we weren't given that opportunity.
Well, I was going to ask about the second proposition. Okay. What evidence did the 7th District leave out?
All sorts of evidence.
So if there's a lot of evidence, shouldn't it go back for a jury trial then?
Well, if you render on the first issue, then you don't have to have any trial on anything. But certainly, if this court chooses just to remand the first issue, then we absolutely, and what we're asking for, is the opportunity to have this issue go to the jury. I can tell you some of the evidence that we would put forth. And this was stuff that was in the record, which, as you've noted, Justice Eklund was not noted at all by the lower court. So they executed a lease. They paid the landowner. They paid him $2.5 million in signing bonus. They paid him a 20% royalty, which has amounted to millions of dollars over time. All of this was above market. They drilled for years into the formation. They publicly stated for years that they were drilling into the Utica / Point Pleasant. There's also evidence of subjective intent, including testifying before the ODNR at a hearing that was contemporaneous with this lease, that they believed internally the Point Pleasant was part of the Utica, and they were planning on drilling wells in the Point Pleasant interval. This is not going in the dead of night and, you know, not showing what they were doing. They were very upfront about what they were doing. None of that record was considered in the decision of the lower court. If I may then end with two legal principles to drive the court's decision here. First, in this de novo review, the plain language of the contract requires the court to define Utica Shale as it was commonly known at the time the lease was entered into. The lower court's insistence on ignoring that contract's plain language and imposing this strict technical reading on the oil and gas lease deletes the phrase from the agreement.
Let me stop you real quick right there. Does it matter whether the family, Tara, understood Utica Shale to be commonly commonly known as Utica Shale to include Point Pleasant?
It actually doesn't, because the fact issue, we don't have to get into parole evidence of the party's intent here. We're looking at extrinsic evidence only to define the special meaning of this word, Utica Shale. And in doing so, what their intent was doesn't matter. The only issue for extrinsic evidence is factually what was commonly known as the Utica Shale.
So you're saying if Point Pleasant was commonly known as part of Utica Shale in the industry, in the business, et cetera, then whether it was commonly known to them is not relevant.
Exactly. And I would also say that the record shows they didn't know about the Point Pleasant one way or another. What they did say is they wanted to earn royalties. And what we know is that you earn royalties geologically from drilling into the Point Pleasant, but everyone, when they're talking about earning royalties, they're talking about the Utica Shale.
What about the reservation of rights aspect of the contract then?
So if I may, the reservation of rights that he points to is just subpart A3 of a whole sentence. That whole sentence uses commonly known as to refer to the Utica Shale as well as to the Marcellus Shale. And each time they repeat the shale's name, Utica or Marcellus, they use a shorthand just a few words later to say Utica Shale without the commonly known as. But if you only read subpart A3 in isolation, as their interpretation is asking you to do, you have still rendered superfluous commonly known as in the grant. And you're creating a conflict between the grant and the reservation that need not be there.
But what did Rice have in mind then for the reservation clause?
I think you could say that they had in mind, exactly as Judge Robb said, that the Point Pleasant was not a formation under what is commonly known as the Utica Shale, because they were thinking that the Point Pleasant is included in the Utica Shale as it was commonly known.
Okay, so again, I guess, unless I didn't understand your answer, so what would be the purpose of the reservation clause?
So the reservation is common in oil and gas leases, where you try to have these mirror provisions. Mm-hmm. We're going to clearly state what is being leased, and then we're going to clearly state what is being reserved. Here, what is clearly being leased is the formation commonly known as the Utica Shale. Then we go through the reservation to see what is being reserved. And the reservation says that what's being reserved is from the top of the formation commonly known as the Utica Shale to blah, 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 to the bottom of the base of the Utica Shale. To any formation below the base of the Utica Shale. To read the contract as a whole would be to read that third subpart. What is being reserved is any formation below
the base.
The base of what is commonly known as the Utica Shale.
And Rice's position is Point Pleasant is between those two.
Exactly. That Point Pleasant is included in what is commonly known as the Utica Shale, so the formation below it would not include the Point Pleasant in the reservation.
Thank you.
I know I have run out of time. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you will receive a decision from the court.